Today, the encounter between a man and a town. The man was Sayyid Qutb, a leading theorist of radical Islamism. Qutb called for government based on Islamic law.
Islam cannot fulfill its role except by taking concrete form in a society, rather in a nation. For man does not listen, especially in this age, to an abstract theory which is not seen materialized in a living society.
From Sayyid Qutb's 1964 book, Milestones, read by an actor. Qutb rejected the ideologies of both East and West, and he decried a hollow materialism that he had seen firsthand at its zenith in America.
I fear that a balance may not exist between America's material greatness and the quality of its people. And I fear that the wheel of life will have turned and the book of time will have closed and America will have added nothing, or next to nothing, to the account of morals that distinguishes man from object and, indeed, mankind from animals.
That reading is from Sayyid Qutb's book, The America I Have Seen. It came out in 1951, after he had spent more than a year in the U.S., much of that time in a Colorado college town. The town was Greeley. A man and a place, each linked to its own utopian vision, Sayyid Qutb and Greeley, Colorado. First, the man. Historian John Calvert has made a study of him.
Sayyid Qutb is one of Islamism's most influential ideologues, Islamism being the effort to establish a state governed by Quranic principles. Qutb was an Egyptian. He was born in 1906 in a small village in southern Egypt called Musha.
I visited Musha, and I consider it the most beautiful village in Egypt.
Journalist Carol Murphy, author of the book Passion for Islam.
It's set on flat fields with black fertile soil, and the village itself has paved alleyways, and it's very cozy.
At age 14, he was sent to an uncle in Cairo to pursue his studies. In his 20s, he qualified as a teacher of Arabic.
He went to work for the Ministry of Education, but he was a prolific writer, and he contributed poetry and novels and literary criticism to the local newspapers.
You know, he also published his first book in 1933. It was Responsibility of Poets.
Thomas Simon lectured on Qutb last year at the University of Northern Colorado.
1949, a book on social justice. He wrote some 40, depending how you count, books. He was an educator. He was very, very concerned with schooling. Politically, he was anti-monarchy, anti-British.
Britain was the de facto colonial power in Egypt. Historian John Calvert says Qutb was very much a product of that environment.
He felt a deep sense of anger and humiliation over the fact that Egyptians and other Muslim peoples were not allowed to forge their own identity free of Western controls.
And Egyptian political scientist Mamoun Fandi says Qutb never felt at ease in Egypt's bustling capital.
He was comfortable with the suburb way out by the Suez Canal, the periphery of things. And this has been a very dominant theme in the writings of Sayyid Qutb, that it's really the periphery that will dominate.
Qutb made an intellectual migration. His writing had been secular, his politics nationalistic. Again, Carol Murphy.
In the 1940s, he began to feel more religious and to look at his intellectual life and his intellectual exploration more through the lens of religion, which has happened to a lot of modern Egyptians.
And then in 1948, Sayyid Qutb was sent overseas by the Egyptian Ministry of Education. His mission, to study curriculum at Colorado State Teachers College. He was 42 years old and not entirely fluent in English.
I see his experience in the United States as part of a long puzzle and a long road that he was on.
I think it was a very important watershed in his intellectual life.
He became very devout, and his trip to the United States, starting in 1948, was really a defining moment for that transformation.
I think what his time in the States did was to confirm in his mind the degeneracy of Western civilization.
Greeley, Colorado, and the fight against degeneracy were no strangers. The town's founder was a crusader named Nathan Meeker. In 1869, he worked as an agricultural writer for Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. It was Greeley who had urged his readers almost 30 years earlier to go west. In 1869, Nathan Meeker and a colleague won Greeley over to their cause. to found an agricultural settlement out west. Grilly told them that their colony would have to be limited to people who shared a common value. The value was temperance.
There are many places in the world you can go to and get drunk, but there are very few places that you can go to where you are obliged to keep sober. I desire, and am in earnest for humanity's sake, that you people build up an asylum under the shadow of the Rocky Mountains, under new circumstances, where you will live by irrigation and flourish in a new clime, where a man can go and cannot get drunk.
Nathan Meeker agreed. He became the first president of the Union Colony of Colorado, the settlement that became Greeley. Meeker was a utopian socialist. He believed in the centrality of rivers and irrigation to civilization. He had lived in the lush farm country of Illinois called Little Egypt, and he dreamt of a new civilization to rival that of the Nile Valley. And when he recruited settlers for his Colorado colony, he sounded utopian themes.
I propose to unite with the proper persons in establishing a colony in Colorado Territory. The persons with whom I would be willing to associate must be temperance men, and ambitious to establish a good society.
This was to be a utopia of the white, the well-to-do, the upright.
In particular, should moral and religious sentiments prevail, for without these qualities man is nothing. At the same time, tolerance and liberality should also prevail.
The spot that Meeker had chosen was near the confluence of two western rivers, the Platte and the Cashlapoudre. On an arid patch, barren of trees, Nathan Meeker erected a home that still stands. Peggy Ford is the town historian.
We are standing in front of the Nathan Cook Meeker home, built in Greeley, Colorado during the summer of 1870.
It can't be more than 20 feet.
No, it's not
across.
Large at all, but at that time it would have stuck out like a sore thumb. Greeley today has the distinction of being a tree city due to the fact that we have water and irrigation, which was not in place at the time that the town was settled. And so all of the trees that you see around here are due to that great gift of water.
Let's go inside.
Inside the Meeker home, we meet John Watson, 80 years old, and the grandson of a colonist who worked on the early irrigation system. That was so important to Greeley that its first families commemorate the founding by celebrating the completion of a ditch.
We have what we call the Union Colony Pioneer Society, and it meets once a year on the close to June the 10th, and that is the date that the number 3 ditch water came in for the first time into this community.
John Watson and town historian Peggy Ford took us to see ditch number 3, where it passes through downtown Greeley, a sluice 12 feet wide and 6 feet deep, lined with cement blocks called riprap.
This is the number 3 ditch at the intersection of 16th Street and 9th Avenue.
Because 16th Street must have been built right over it.
Yes.
Right here.
Yes. And it goes from the northwest to the southeast.
And this public works project from 1870, this may look pretty modest today, but
right.
For 1870, this gave life to this town.
It gave the life to the town, sure did.
Irrigation meant farming, which made Greeley thrive. It meant the sheltering shade of trees. And it meant a triumph of humanity over nature in front of every house, a decorative, unnaturally green lawn. Over the years, Greeley, Colorado prospered. Cattle ranches brought both wealth and the permanent smell of livestock. The population today is 165,000, and the State Teachers College, where Sayed Kutub, the Egyptian writer, studied for half of 1949, became today's University of Northern Colorado. Frank Lakin, Jack Meekins, Betty Hines, and Peggy Griffith were students back in 1949. They don't remember Sayed Kutub, but they do remember Greeley, Colorado, as it appeared to them in those days.
Greeley was at that time a relatively small town, probably around 15, 16,000.
It was a dry town.
You could walk downtown, go to Clark and Faulkner Drug and have an ice cream cone.
The biggest thing we used to do was probably short sheet somebody's bed or hang all of their furniture out on ropes outside of their dorm.
The girls had to be in their dorms by 10:30 at night. The faculty were expected to be in coat and tie.
The fraternities and sororities would get together on Sunday afternoons, and believe it or not, we would have tea.
The evening meal, you were expected to dress up, and everyone went to the evening meal at the same time. It was served family style.
Said grace?
Yes.
We thank thee, Lord, for daily bread as by our hand, and on and on and on.
By all accounts, Greeley was a close-knit place, home to farmers, professors, and aspiring teachers, and for a few months in the late 1940s, to one Islamist ideologue in the making, the Egyptian writer Sayyid Qutb. Historian John Calvert.
He would wander the tree-lined streets of the residential neighborhoods in the evening, and he was amazed at how few people ventured out. Those Americans, or Greeley residents that he did see outside, were tending their lawn. And in his view, this was the chief preoccupation of the American householder. And for him, it was indicative of the individually selfish and materialistic way of life of America in general.
To John Watson and Betty Hines, who grew up around those lawns, Sayyid Qutb missed the point. The lawn celebrated irrigation, cultivation, self-sufficiency.
I think the beauty of Greeley has been that there's been ample water to have beautiful green lawns and beautiful yards.
Even in the most humble neighborhoods, the lawns were beautifully cared for.
America in 1949 was not a natural fit for Qutb. He was a man of color, and the United States was still largely segregated. He was an Arab. American public opinion favored Israel, which had come into existence just a year before. He wrote the book The America I Have Seen in Arabic, and in it, Qutb offered a twisted chronology of American history. He informed his Arab readers that it began with bloody wars against the Indians, which he claimed were still underway in 1949. He wrote that before independence, American colonists pushed Latinos south toward Central America, even though the American colonists themselves had not yet pushed west of the Mississippi. Then came the Revolution, which he called a destructive war, led by George Washington. In sum,
the American is by his very nature a warrior who loves combat.
And in other respects, Americans were equally primitive. When it came to culture, some Americans, he wrote, liked symphonies and opera, but Hollywood movies substituted craft for European elegance, and jazz was the primitive music of popular choice.
It is the music that the savage bushmen created to satisfy their primitive desires, their desire for noise on the one hand and the abundance of animal noises on the other.
Primitiveness was a feature of American dress, too.
Screaming, loud colors, and elaborate large patterns, a lion or tiger leaping on the chest, a naked girl stretched on a necktie from top to bottom, or a palm tree that climbs up it from bottom to top.
Americans lived for their bodies alone. Men pursued bodybuilding. Women pursued a superficial perfection.
Beauty queens float in on a high tide of pulchritude to vie for the title of Miss America of 1948.
The American female, according to Sayyid Qutb, was a temptress, acting her part in a sexual system that he described as biological.
The American girl is well acquainted with her body's seductive capacity. She knows it lies in the face and in expressive eyes and thirsty lips. She knows seductiveness lies in the round breasts, the full buttocks, and in the shapely thighs, sleek legs, and she shows all this and does not hide it.
Students of the day don't recall the co-eds of 1949 quite that way. Here are Frank Lakin, Jack Meekins, Betty Hines, Bob Hynek, and Peggy Griffith.
If he described it that way last year, I would buy into it. But in 1949, the women were bobby socks.
Rolled down. They had to be white. They had on saddle shoes.
And skirts and blouses.
All of our skirts were below our knees.
Made up, yeah. And they had their hair done. But their dress was very conservative.
We didn't have any nose piercings and lip piercings and tongue piercings and stuff like that.
You know, I was a cheerleader, and we had to go down on our knees and make sure that the skirt would hit the floor of the basketball court or the football field before you could wear that anything any shorter than that, certainly.
But what compounded Sayyid Qutb's nausea at an animalistic American sexuality was what he saw as its acceptance within the American church, specifically at a dance in a Greeley church basement.
They danced to the tunes of the gramophone, and the dance floor was replete with tapping feet, enticing legs, arms wrapped around waists, lips pressed to lips, and chests pressed to chests. The atmosphere was full of desire. When the minister descended from his office, he advanced to the gramophone to choose a song that would befit this atmosphere and encourage the males and females who were still seated to participate. And the father chose. He chose a famous American song called Baby, It's Cold Outside.
I really can't stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you'd drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hands.
And the minister waited until he saw people stepping to the rhythm of this moving song, and he seemed satisfied and contented. He left the dance floor for his home, leaving the men and the women to enjoy this night in all its pleasure and innocence.
Boy, I must have missed something. I'd be interested in knowing what church that was. It couldn't have been the Baptist.
There weren't really dances in the churches, but there were teen dances. It was a youth center.
The dances were all the same. One, two, one, two, three, four, boom.
We did a lot of jitterbug.
Swing, you did foxtrot.
Latin tune once in a while.
Occasionally a little rumba.
It was well supervised.
I assume it wasn't all an invitation to wanton sexuality.
No, it wasn't.
Maybe we were all too naive to really know what was going on in somebody else's mind, but
churches,
it certainly wasn't anything in our own minds.
If American women were vixens, then American men were primitive brutes.
This primitiveness can be seen in the spectacle of the fans as they follow a game of football, or watch boxing matches, or bloody, monstrous wrestling matches. Is one of animal excitement born of their love for hardcore violence? Destroy his head, crush his ribs, beat him to a pulp. This spectacle leaves no room for doubt as to the primitiveness of the feelings of those who are enamored with muscular strength and desire it.
A college wrestling match this year in Greeley. To the University of Northern Colorado wrestling coach Jack Maum, the young men on the mat are learning something.
I don't know of a harder sport than wrestling.
So discipline, hard work,
commitment.
Individualism.
Yes.
These are all virtues of the sport.
I believe.
The visitor to Greeley in 1949, Sayyid Qutb, the Egyptian, mm-hmm. He seemed to find something excessively violent about our taste in sports, us Americans. Football and this were examples of that to him. Mm-hmm. Too violent a sport?
There is a little bit of toughness and grit to it. It is a hard sport. But again, I think a lot of things in life are hard.
Sayyid Qutb has his defenders on his observations about everything from American materialism to muscle building.
I believe that he was looking at bodybuilding from the point of view of the feeding of vanity and narcissism. This is something which he would have equally criticized Muslim cultures for.
Idris Hamid teaches philosophy and religion at nearby Colorado State University. He included Qutb's writings in a course last year on liberation theology.
Islam is a social way of life, and it involves preferring one's brother or one's sister to one's own self. So this is the kind of background that Sayyid Qutb is coming from, but the individualism of Western civilization as manifested in sports like bodybuilding, for an example, he would have considered to be detrimental.
But the historian John Calvert reads Qutb's views of America and sees something reminiscent of what many Arab writers decry in Western accounts of their societies.
Qutb's discourse on America sort of mimics the Orientalist discourse, you know, of Westerners as regards the Middle East. Many Westerners throughout the decades of the 20th century were visiting the Islamic Middle East and painting a rather negative view of what they witnessed there, an essentialist vision of Islamic civilization. And I think Qutb is doing the same as regards the United States and the West.
The Egyptian political scientist Mamoun Fandi says that's giving Qutb's account of the U.S. too much credit. His command of English and American history were scant compared to European scholars of the East, he says. As for Qutb's shock at American sexuality circa 1949, Fandi notes that Qutb's life story betrays no evidence of any sexual relationships at all. For Mamoun Fandi, Qutb's writing from America wasn't really about America or Americans.
It was really a critique of Egypt, using America as a kind of... it's a foil, you know. America is really some kind of a foil that he used to criticize Egyptian society.
Fandi says Qutb was warning Egyptians of the West, of modernity, of things they were very attracted to.
There was a sort of a revolution in Egyptian thought at the time, more openness toward liberal thought and more argument that actually Egypt is a Mediterranean country. It is part of Europe. It is not part of the Arab world. It's not part of Africa. It has always been European. In a sense, Sayyid Qutb was the counterpoint to all this trend. It's about authenticity. It's about Islam. That's what Egypt ought to be and what's Egypt's mission is all about.
Back in Egypt, Sayyid Qutb, as a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, was accused of plotting against the government. He was jailed and in 1966 executed. In his prison writings, Qutb equated governments like Egypt's with the pre-Islamic tribes of Arabia. They represented a state of ignorance. Islam offered liberation. His books inspired Islamists in Egypt and elsewhere. Greeley, Colorado's founder, Nathan Meeker, also met a violent end in 1879. He had become a federal Indian agent, and ever the Christian agrarian reformer, he tried to make farmers of the White River Utes. They rose up and killed Meeker and 10 of his employees. The town that he founded remained conservative, but Greeley hasn't been dry since 1969. And in an unmarked storefront next to the Roma restaurant, there is a makeshift mosque. There are Arab students at the University of Northern Colorado, and several told me that they'd been unaware until this past year that an Egyptian writer named Sayyid Qutb had preceded them to Greeley more than 50 years ago.